I think it's a recorder.
It's just a recorder, it's not a film.
Yeah.
Okay. So this came from a challenging formulation which came up in committee. I rather think it was Danielle who is the guilty party for this. And I'm not going to be as controversial as that, because I think that they mutually illuminate one another. Marshall McLuhan's life work, Fusing Message and Medium, radically connects technology with the transformation of significance and expression. And the Elliot Leavis conception of the dissociation of sensibility also radically implies that civilization changes expression. Civilization does not change merely purely spiritually, and that must surely imply that technology changes expression. So they're not as opposed as they might be assumed to be. We find this recognized in, for example, Middlemarch, Dombey and Son, and Anna Karenina. Should we go to the other extent and say, is the whole of Marshall McLuhan implicit in Leavis? They do not destroy one another, but if we allow them to illuminate each other, profound connections and reciprocal alteration of perspective unfold, and new questions arise for both of them. McLuhan was associated with Leavis for the years of his studentship at Cambridge, and through his doctoral work, and the underlying connections between them are very profound. Some of McLuhan's work in some of its successes might be taken to be associated with some of the more unfortunate effects of a watered-down deconstruction, and perhaps from one Leavisian point of view, to encourage a shallowly anti-canonical and relativistic tendency in media studies and similar enterprises. It's often utopian and neglects the downside. McLuhan is not a man to qualify either his views or his vigorous antitheses, which sometimes makes one wince when reading him. Nevertheless, I want to argue he is a profound dialectical thinker who instinctively understood, for example, the principles of the internet and related phenomena long before they came into existence. So I'm going to focus on two important works. The later work, Understanding Media, from 1964, which is, so to say, his manifesto of the global village and the media, medium is the message. And his much earlier doctoral dissertation, The Classical Trivium, The Place of Thomas Nash in the Learning of His Time. And in that earlier and remarkable work, The Classical Trivium of Grammar, Dialectics and Rhetoric is pursued over 2,000 years through the ancient world up to Augustine, from Augustine to Abelard, from Abelard to Erasmus, before finally reaching harbour in Thomas Nash in terms of those three canons. Again, yep. Behind McLuhan, as with Lawrence, as with Jung, as with T.S. Eliot, ultimately stands Heraclitus. Wisdom is one thing, it is to know the thought by which things are steered through all things. Burnett's translation, which of course someone like Heidegger would contest profoundly. The deeper implications in Heraclitus are that this is the basis of what McLuhan is calling the grammatical dimension of the logos. The non-nominalistic intelligibility of the universe through the medium of the language by which we interact with it. And it leads on to Stoicism. But Heraclitus also opens ways to dialectic as the logical testing of evidence. Eyes and ears are bad witnesses to men if they have souls that understand not their language. Men do not know how what is at variance agrees with itself. It is an attunement of opposite tensions like that of the bow and the lyre. In this, both dialectic and rhetoric are here in embryo, and indeed the dialectical relationship in the Heraclitian Hegelian sense between the three dimensions continues for the whole 2,000-year period he is discussing. As we see in the next section on dialectics, he writes on page 123 of the Trivium, the codifiers of canon law, working with the grammarians' techniques over their discordant texts, helped to bring about the great dialectical activity of the 12th century. Thus law, which shuns logic, but needs grammar and fosters rhetoric, paradoxically helped to produce the renaissance of dialectics. This emphasizes once more the complex bonds which join together the rival sisters of the Trivium. As a post-Hegelian, like Karl Marx, McLuhan evolves his position into a dialectical process based in actualities. In the Trivium, McLuhan in effect invokes the three dimensions as operators, whose mutual struggle defined 2,000 years of civilization, up to 1600 or thereabouts. Their collapse thereafter would define for him what Eliot and Leavis were happy to call the dissociation of sensibility. When we come back to Leavis in this light, certain things stand out more starkly, very starkly. But I'll quote a few epitomes of what McLuhan is doing, of the dialectical process driven by technologies, not primarily money, though of course in his terms money too is a technology, in contrast to Marx. And this is what he invokes. Each new technology creates an environment that is itself regarded as corrupt and degrading. Yet the new one turns its predecessor into an art form. When writing was new, Plato transformed the old oral dialogue into an art form. When printing was new, the Middle Ages became an art form. The Elizabethan worldview was a view of the Middle Ages. And the Industrial Age turned the Renaissance into an art form, as seen in the works of Jakob Burckhardt, and we could add Nietzsche to that as well. Siegfried Gideon, in turn, and this would relate to Lurker in Women in Love, has in the Electric Age taught us to see the entire process of mechanization as an art process. The aspiration of our time for wholeness, empathy, and depth of awareness is a natural adjunct of electric technology. The age of mechanical industry that preceded us found vehement expression of private outlook, the natural mode of expression. Every culture and every age has its favorite model of perception and knowledge that it is inclined to prescribe for everybody and everything. The mark of our time is revulsion against imposed patterns. We're suddenly eager to have things and people declare their beings totally. There is a deep faith to be found in this new attitude. Such is the faith in which this book has been written. It explores the contours of our own extended beings in our technologies, seeking the principle of intelligibility in each of them. And there, in effect, McLuhan is going back to the grammatical conception that is foundational for his whole work.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Men are never aware of the ground rules of their environmental systems or cultures. Today, technologies and their consequent environments succeed each other so rapidly that one environment makes us aware of the next. Technologies begin to perform the function of art in making us aware of the psychic and social consequences of technology. I'm not sure whether it's gone too far. Go. Go on. And one more. That's it. The student today lives mythically and in depth. At school, however, he encounters a situation organized by means of classified information in the Aristotelian sense, a hierarchy. The student can find no possible means of involvement for himself, nor can he discover how the educational scene relates to the mythic world of electronically processed data and experience that he takes for granted. And then a sentence that really suggests that he had an inner vision of the internet back in 1964. TV is only one component of the electric environment of instant circuitry that has succeeded the old world of the wheel and nuts and bolts. We would be foolish not to ease our transition from the fragmented world of the existing educational establishment by every possible means. I'll now consider the tension of grammar and dialectics, which in the Trivium, McLuhan considers the fundamental tension, since the position of rhetoric, associated with Cicero in particular, occupies a kind of mediatorial position in the Christian epoch, from Augustine and Alcuin, who I believe is associated with York, to Erasmus. I will use Wittgenstein as a graphic modern instance who is illuminated by the connections McLuhan makes, both in the earlier and the later McLuhan, and this will then lead me on to where Leavis stands in all of this. In terms of McLuhan's conceptions in the Trivium, Wittgenstein moves from dialectic in the Tractatus to grammar in the Philosophical Investigations. In terms of the conceptions of understanding media, Wittgenstein moves from the Tractatus's objectivism of the industrial scientific epoch to the inclusivity of medium of the electrical epoch in the Investigations. There's still a lot of dialectic and deep residual conflict between dialectic and grammar in the Philosophical Investigations, as there also is in Leavis. Deconstructive methods shared by Wittgenstein and Leavis, as well as Derrida, are dialectical. Nevertheless, Leavis and the later Wittgenstein are still essentially grammarians in McLuhan's terms. The Philosophical Investigations, seen through McLuhan's eyes, should have been called by the name of Derrida's book of grammatology. Its invocation of an embodied potency of language through which language exists as creative force in its own right, not as merely replicative, expresses, like Vico, Johann Georg Hermann, and William Blake and Coleridge, whether inadvertently or not inadvertently, something of the ancient conception, especially the Hebrew conception, of language and names as vehicles of cosmic creation and cosmic existence. The essence of the Philosophical Investigations is that significance is wholly bound up with the form, the linguistic form, which constitutes it. Language creates meaning. The medium is the message. Language is pure process and enactivity. It does not relate as pure representation, as in the Tractatus, to an other, which can simply be apart from it. Rather, it incorporates into itself an other which cannot be conceived of without its social multiplicity of forms and processes. And then a very remarkable quotation, which is so close to Leavis, from Wittgenstein. We speak of understanding a sentence in the sense in which it can be replaced by another which says the same, but also in the sense in which it cannot be replaced by any other, any more than one musical theme can be replaced by another. In the one case, the thought in the sentence is something common to different sentences, in the other, something that is expressed only by these words in these positions. And then he says in a bracket, understanding a poem. The essence of philosophical investigations and its incessant Socratic Zen exposures of implications is actually that all language is the second kind, even when it appears to be of the first kind. And this is Leavis's implicit message also, since Leavis ever more fully and comprehensively recognizes the inactive performative dimension of all language. Iconically, he does this in his riposte to Snow. Likewise, J.L. Austin in Austin's Evolution in How to Do Things with Words towards the ubiquity of performativity in all sentential communication illustrates the same process. I now turn to Leavis in relation to McLuhan. Leavis and Dennis Thompson of Culture and Environment, Mrs. Leavis in Fiction and the Reading Public, in the context also of the radical developments in process analysis of poetry associated with the names of Mansfield Forms, I.A. Richards, William Empson, were pioneers in media studies and the recognition of media instrumentality. McLuhan's affiliate student time at Cambridge and his doctoral studies on the trivium were saturated in this ethos. When Leavis turns to the university, he turns to the 17th century, the dissociation of sensibility, the pioneering model of interdisciplinary studies in education and the university uses the 17th century as his template. Charles Winder's notes in Essays and Documents give us the striking remark, in the 17th century a great transition occurred. England was medieval in 1603 and modern in 1700. That's a quotation from Leavis by Charles Winder. Economic political revolution. The economic reality deployed by Johnson in his satires is anti-capitalist. And then a very McLuhan-esque comment. It is the imminence of the change which produces the awareness in Johnson and the general nostalgia. In the words of Dombey and Son, the first shock of a great earthquake had, just at that period, rent the whole neighborhood to its center. The coming of the railway in Dombey and Son, that's probably in the 17th century, the impact of the printing press. And the general statement in Education and the University puts a very similar line of argument. The reason for choosing the given period are contained in that phrase thrown out above, key passage in the history of civilization. The 17th century is preeminently that, and with some reference outside, of course, it lends itself admirably to study, integrating study in terms of England. It is at one end in direct and substantial continuity with the world of Dante, and it shows us at the other a world which has broken irretrievably with the medieval order, committed itself completely to the process leading rapidly and directly to what we live in now. In the course of it, capitalism arrives, finally overcoming the traditional resistances, so that its ethos becomes accepted as law, morality, and controlling spirit in the economic realm. The realm of parliamentary rule begins, as does that of economic nationalism. Crucial issues in the relation between church and state, the spiritual and the secular, religion and the individual, are decided in a spirit going against the tradition of centuries. The principle of toleration is established along with that of business is business. The notion of society as an organism gives way to that of society as a joint stock company. And he references R.H. Tawney, Protestant and the Rise of Capitalism, in the footnote. Science launches decisively on its triumphant accelerating advance. The mention of these main heads is enough to enforce the point that the study of the 17th century is a study of the modern world. Let complexities emerge. In the Clark Lectures, English Literature in Our Time and the University, Leavis goes on to tie all this profoundly to a synthesis of the emphases of Eliot and Lawrence in relation to this movement of civilization as designated by the notion dissociation of sensibility. In the process, he connects it to the dramatic and the ordinary speech character, the process character of integrated poetry, as opposed to the linear movements of 18th century verse. He's elsewhere illustrated that by reference to Johnson's criticism and the chasm between Antony and Cleopatra and All for Love. In the 20th century, this becomes the difference between Swinburne and Eliot's Portrait of a Lady, The Hollow Men and Ash Wednesday. The complexities here are intensified when we recognize that Coleridge, Keats, and Byron, in both prose and poetry, not to mention Boswell and Jane Austen in prose, and the 19th century novelists, do have a profound grasp of process and of the living interwoven dramatic immediacy of thought and language. In the Trivium, McLuhan himself relates Nash across the centuries to the master of process, James Joyce. So is the recognition of process more connected to the historicity of moments of transition rather than simply to a change in media? Is the recognition of the reality of the medium is the message and the global village also, in the world of Facebook and Twitter, a recognition of a truncation, not merely an opening? And in a way, McLuhan here is the reverse or the obverse of Leavis's tendency towards cultural nostalgia. Does McLuhan's dialectic too have something of the oversimplifying effects that Marx and Freud may have upon us? To reconcile all of this, we need to begin to consider how the deep awareness of temporality involved in awareness of historicity could be combined with the emphasis upon immediacy which the electric world can bring. Now I need to... Can you take it on? I'm going to play two clips from adverts. The first one is from about 1983, in the midst of Margaret Thatcher, and it expresses the sense of history in parody, but very delightfully, that is the kind of historicity that we're talking about when we think of people like Leavis, Heidegger, Dilthey, and so on. But the second one, 10 years later, a Guinness advert from the early 90s, the epoch just emerging of Tony Blair, is completely postmodern, and it's absolutely medium is message and message is medium. I'll play them for you. Ah, we've no sound, have we? Oh yes.
I walked about a bit on my own. Oh no. I strolled around without anyone else. Oh dear, oh dear. I wandered lonely that floats on high or fails and kills.
Only Heineken can do this. The precious of poets, other peers cannot read.
And now the Guinness advert. This change has occurred in 10 years. Pure image, it's pure medium. There's no real logic to it, it's just got a pretense of logic. Right. So, the problem it seems to me we face, we Levisians, we Heideggerians, we Dilthiites, we mythopoeic people, are can the awareness of that dimension be combined with an awareness of historicity. The awareness of historicity that is in the contrast of those two clips is, it seems to me, for the most part, what has ceased to become operative in the awareness of education in the modern world. And yet at the same time, we have never lived in an age where so much transitional historicity is occurring. How can we find a way to hold them together so that we can raise the awareness of today's students and studies of civilization to both dimensions of the present, but also of the living past in relation to the present? Thank you.
What I meant was that when he made his account of the step, not so much the big change, but what the change was from, it seems to me people like Raymond Williams and whatnot, that's not really an account of what it was really like. So I think it's possible because it could be both of these things. Raymond Williams or Marx's perception or his perception of the past. So when it becomes a historical argument, in a way it sort of gets lost in the range of possibilities of the particular set of perceptions which make you focus on this. So what I really meant was that leaders could say, well, as he did, of course, yeah, yeah, all that is true, but actually the bit that really matters to us is, you know, is this bit. And I was looking at myth not as something thrust on history, but as something elicited from, you know, from history. So that's all I meant really by the possibility that, you know, that could be enabling. In other words, it could be vulnerable to that sort of religious criticism at a certain historical level. But yet, we're still having some justification. That's about as far as I've got.
So it would be like a sort of collection of forms.
Yeah.
Could I come in on this?
Okay.
And this connects very much with what you were saying, Michael, as well. I think that Leibniz paradoxically becomes more Nietzschean as he goes on, and that comes out when he's talking about the 19th century again in English literature in our time in the university of Clarkson. When he talks about the Romantic period having brought into existence a new sense of human responsibility, and when he talks about Dickens's novels and Turner's paintings as representing something Promethean, I think he does actually begin to engage with a new myth, which is a very Nietzschean kind of myth, a Protagorean Nietzschean myth of a Promethean quality in modern man. And I think when he's writing about the 17th century, although of course he's critiquing a Macaulay-like reductive view of uninterrupted progress, he's also infused with the extraordinary energy of it, and that came out in the remarks that I quoted. And so I think there's a paradox that there is part of Leibniz which is very nostalgic indeed, and indeed ideological in the way you were saying, but at the same time there's a different quality which would take him much closer to someone like Nietzsche, someone like Marx in his utopianism, and someone like McLuhan. So I think there is a... I don't think that Leibniz can be convicted of complete guiltlessness of being mythopoeic. I think he is definitely mythopoeic, quite a lot.
In the scores of people, the authors of Cassidy, Danielle, Sophie, and then Marie Lintard.
Yes,
probably a very obvious question, but I'll ask it
anyway. Can we really approach Leibniz with lassity in applying creativity across his system? Was he creative and occupied with creativity inherent in the deployment of the language?
Oh, certainly, yeah.
So why should we approach him not being equal in applying the notion of
science and... Well, as far as I understand it, Leibniz is making, you know, exactly that point, that language is the medium of creativity and thought. But the institutionalized processes, research, knowledge, and thinking, etc., are divided into, you know, disciplines. And it seems to me one would want to think of them, and I imagine that if challenged, we would say yes, you know, that they are, they're all contributing in some way. But at the same time, he wants to preserve for, you know, the poetic imagination, the, as it were, the function of critically testing or you know, developing these other, you know, disciplines. It seems to me, you know, the way he talks about philosophy, we quite understand, you know, what was going on around him as philosophy at the time or whatever. But he, it seems to me, he accepts that account of of philosophy in a way that he wouldn't for literature. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't, you know, that seems to me, I mean, your point is exactly right, but it doesn't seem to me to affect my point. That's what I suppose what I'm saying.
Yeah. As a philosopher, my artistic conception of the language, I don't have to go into the various disciplines and what really is interested in is understanding the notion of creativity within the focus of the deployment of language, the focus of language, not any language, not in any language. I think that's the difference.
Yes, please.
I think if we think in terms of a potential or heuristic Leavesian view, and not necessarily one that is confined to his Ipsissima Dixit, a wider sense of creativity is completely compatible with a Leavesian understanding. So, for example, the kind of analyses of creativity in art, in humour, and in science that Koester came up with in the 60s, and the work that E.H. Gombrich did in art, which is explicitly used by Leavis, and of course Polanyi comes in here as well. I think that Leavis would have assumed that a broadly Kantian account of the irreducibility of the framing of the human world as including science as well as art would have been accurate, I would have thought.
Is the dissociation of sensibility, which of course featured largely in both talks, and the question of how that relates to the mythopoeic, if that's the word. Now, it seems to me that Leavis unjustly of imposing his nostalgic view of the 17th century or whatever. And I say unjustly because I think he demonstrates some things anyway, with this notion of the dissociation of sensibility. Which, by the way, not long ago, was one of the bits of Eliot and Leavis that my students said they simply couldn't understand. I think you go to Leavis's essay on
indeed,
the dissociation of sensibility.
Yeah.
And you proceed by the most ordinary methods of literary criticism. You read it, that's what is there.
But implicit in it is an understanding of historicity. It's that ability to use literary texts to discern different modes of consciousness which different phases of civilization have.
Yes.
And that's what Leavis is writing about, that's what McLuhan is writing about, and that's what the present generation finds it very hard to grasp at all.
Well, the present generation finds it very hard to grasp literary studies at all. It seems to me that it's parts of the same thing.
Yeah, I have two points to make. The first is, do people always think in language? I think there must be people who think in mathematics. I mean, what has happened is, as far as any layman can understand it, that mathematical thinking has presented an ultimate picture of the world which is pretty well unintelligible even to common sense, as common sense has been. It couldn't have been reached by any kind of linguistic argument that had to use mathematics. And that's why one of the difficulty of this sort of advanced Finnish view of the world
is almost ungraspable, even when it's explained as simply as this Italian physicist has tried to do in a recent. The second point is related to Hewitt. I got distinct whiffs of Marx all through, and I wondered why Marx was excluded. He seems to be the ultimate thinker.
I didn't exclude him, I mentioned him.
To changes in the relationship of people to the needs of production. And there were the bit about the 17th century was pure Marx, I thought. Pure Marx. And why? There's an avoidance of Marxist thinking for quite perhaps obvious.
You're preaching to the choir here.
I think Terry Eagle is the only one who generously admits and admires Marx. Why Marx was right seems to be a reason people might take up. The third one is the question of myth-making. Actually, the point is the myth of the First World War, it seems to me, which you find both in Sassoon and Owen, is that it is a matter of passive suffering. I always thought that Yeats's much derided exclusion of Owen and Sassoon from the Octave Book of Modern Verse had something to be said to it, though I would not got the exclusion for the argument that it was passive suffering. You wouldn't think they'd killed anybody. War is a matter of being killed and killing. In Douglas's work, in the Second World War, the act killing is part of the war poetry in a way that it is not in others. But also the question is, because it was related by Michael really to controversies about, you know, strategy. There's a fundamental object to the First World War. It was a waste of life, completely and utterly. And the point was that Owen, like Rosenberg, was in touch with and knew of the teachings of Leo Tolstoy, who in his latest period became a complete Christian pacifist. As a matter of fact, there was in Owen's final battle, a book of Tolstoy's fabulous stories, together with an introduction by and he clearly read this book because he recommended it to his mother. I'm glad you read the talk. And in fact, there are evidences that he's been influenced by Tolstoy's family. And it also comes with Rosenberg, who's... Tolstoy was respected by Jews because he was completely non-anti-Semitic. A pamphlet, pro-Zionist pamphlet, which I found as part of the George Orwell collection, it begins, quotation Tolstoy, "The Jews are a great people." That is the first. That is the first one. So you've got to take the pacifist thinking coming from Tolstoy into account. And also the way that the English poets distort the war as if it was just people dying as cattle and doing nothing with the dead. And Max Plowman, he said, "Dying is for your country is easy compared with killing for your country."
Malcolm, I think you're indulging in a little bit of rodomatade in this remark about Marx, because I made it very clear in my paper that Marx is an analogy to what McLuhan is doing, and I would take for granted that Marx's analyses, I think the problem with them is they've actually been assimilated so much that we take them for granted rather than that we disregard them. So, but I agree with you on that. As regards the war, I would absolutely agree with you on that one. And I think one of the things that Jean was communicating about Rosenberg is precisely that he doesn't take sides against the goodness and the badness of war. He just describes and evokes it how it is. Going on to Tolstoy from that, let's not forget that another man spent the whole of the war, a follower of Tolstoy in some senses, but nevertheless, as an officer in the First World War, and that was Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein went through the entire First World War and as a combatant, and he had to deal with his spiritual understanding of Tolstoy's position in relation to what he was actually doing in the fighting. So, and the element of activism in his later philosophy, I would think, is not wholly unrelated to that. That's my point. Of course it's a paradox. There are a lot of conflicts in Wittgenstein.
Contribution. I mean, I also puzzle over the question of mathematics, you know, whether it can be assimilated, you know, human consciousness just being fundamentally linguistic.
Yeah, we teach set theory in primary school now, whereas in Russell and Whitehead, three massive volumes were devoted to making sense of set theory. Well, so there has been an assimilation.
You raise the question. I don't know what the answer, you know, would be. You know, I'm sure there are people who think mathematically, you know, directly into symbols. You know. So I don't know where that, you know, would lead us into chaos, because it could be ultimately some language. No answer for that one.
John, is
it? Charles?
I think I can follow this bridge. So thank you very much.
Any more? Stephen? Question
to Michael. I'm interested in Michael's presented at the end. I was wondering whether you thought about understanding the reaction would probably resonate more to the parabolic. In the sense of the parable is a way of the kind of festival is a trump down version of Nick. And I just wondered whether in terms of Lucas's historical interest and the way he kind of envisages education and helping people to see one
Yes. I don't know whether I should add anything useful to that. When you say being a leader, I think part of the point I'm making about leaders is they sort of spread out the possibilities of all men in the family. Some are conscious of it. And it's a question of the degree of consciousness, not the degree of myth fear. Or I think what was in my argument was the sense that maybe Leavis could have, or we could, on his behalf, when we raise his thought to more self-consciousness of the mythic factor in it, as opposed to these other writers, other modernists around him that he was very closely attuned to in many ways. But it was the ones who were most self-consciously mythopoeic that he was not not, it seems, very attuned to that dimension of them. So it's not whether he was more or less mythopoeic, but the degree of consciousness of that, both in himself and in others. So how that would then relate to the question of parable, I mean, it's the poet who's using the parable, not Lever, so you've sort of jumped. You use that to jump off for?
Yeah.
Just a question whether that kind of made a link between the parable and whether that kind of helped
people thinking. Well, yes, I mean, I could see that parable would provide a kind of self-conscious and familiar and traditional form, which would bypass these other levels of myth that I've been talking about. And in that sense, that could probably be the case. Yeah.
I think you're onto something very important here, Stephen. I'll give one illustration, which is an intriguing one, in his discussion of Little Dorrit, when he discusses the moment when Little Dorrit, Amy Dorrit, challenges whether there's a justice in the fact that he has not only to have served, her father not only has to have served a huge length of time in the Marshalsea and been destroyed in the process, but he has to pay in money both, she says. And Clennam responds by saying this is right, and Dickens comments that this was the only speck that Clennam had ever seen on Little Dorrit while he'd been in the prison, the only speck of the prison he saw on her. And Lewis comments, the speck is of course on Clennam. Now that is an allusion to the story in the Gospel of the mote and the beam. Why do you make this fuss about the speck of dust in your brother's eye, and you ignore the great plank in your own, which is, amongst other things, one of the first accounts of projection that we have. And I think that Lewis is saturated with the New Testament. I think his interest in both King Lear and in Measure for Measure comes from that. And therefore, and he's also very well aware of the background to Shakespearean drama in the medieval, the mystery plays, and all that kind of thing, and going back to the Middle Ages. And of course, he's saturated in Dante as well. So I think that there's a book to be written about this, what you're saying.
Well, I think the book should be written by having some lunch first. I've asked you to thank both our speakers, and
thank you very much.
I believe there's some lunch downstairs waiting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.